conference. Well, it is time, 1 o'clock. I'm EJ. I'm going to be your chair for today. I'm the curator of collector of the Museum of Transology, but I'm also working project managing a collection of 150 oral, queer oral testimonies across the north of England. It's the biggest collection of oral histories outside of London that's been built, and we're really hoping that it sort of breaks the stranglehold of London's sort of queer community over every other region in the UK. So that's where I'm coming from for this session. And I also built a collection of oral histories called Brighton Transformed. And you can see them with full transcripts online if anyone's interested in UK trans oral histories. Not about me, more about now. So we have this afternoon's session, we're looking at the title In Our Own Words, Bisexual and Homo and Queer Identity in Old and New Oral History Sources. We've got three great speakers with quite different content, so it's going to be interesting to see how we can thread through some common narratives. First speaker, Jędrzej Buster, is a research assistant at the University of Warsaw, working in the international research project Cruising the 1970s, weren't we all, love? Cruising the 1970s, unearthing pre-HIV AIDS queer cultures. Jędrzej has recently successfully, and I really like the use of this word that I'm hearing a lot over here in Germany, defended their PhD. And so with lots and lots of congratulations to you for that.
Thank you.
It was on queering American science fiction literature. He's participated in several ethnographic and sociological research projects, investigating both contemporary issues of culture as well as historical accounts of Polish-Soviet relations in the communist period. How lovely to be thinking outside of Western Europe. Okay, here you go. Thank you very much for your time and your energy.
Yes, so today I won't be talking about science fiction, but about history, about queering history, and about the last 2 years that I've been working in the Cruising Project, working on uncovering the unknown queer history of Poland, of socialist Poland, focusing on the 1970s. So today I want to talk about what I was doing in this project, to talk about this specific queer archive of male homosexuality that I've been collecting together with my interview partners, and then to talk about what this archive means and how it can be used, and then how it can be, I hope, expanded by further research about in Poland and on Polish queer history. So the title of my paper today, How to Talk About Homosexuality That Didn't Exist, is a quote from one of my interview partners, and I think it's a very good indicator of the specific status of homosexuality in Poland in the 1970s, or broadly in the People's Republic of Poland. The Cruising Project focuses on the 1970s, which in our Polish team, we looked at it as a kind of longer period than strictly the decade of the 1970s, so we chose to talk about the long 70s, from 1970 to 1985. And when we began to work in this project, the first problem discovered or were made aware of was the lack of or the absence of a queer archive about 1970s. Poland, queer Poland, and it's important, and that's why in my research I focused on ethnographic interviews, on oral history interviews with Polish queers, because of precisely the absence of written materials. It's the 1970s in Poland were a specific time for Polish, for the Polish homosexual communities and movement. Not until the 1990s can we talk about a emergence of a gay movement and a political emancipation of gays. And in the 70s, although homosexuality was decriminalized in Poland in 1932, and compared to other socialist states, Poland was quite liberal in terms of the treatment of queer people. At the same, there were no persecutions or no, for example, raid on gay bars. But at the same time, there were no gay bars as such. So this was very specific. There were gay-friendly cafes and such places, but there wasn't anything that we could call a kind of gay scene in cities. So at the, this is the specific dynamic of this historical period where it is not criminalized, but at the same time there is this feeling of an invisibility of homosexuality in the public discourse. Homosexuality was a taboo subject, and that was not spoken about publicly. And the men that I interviewed were, in a way, telling me their life narratives that happened outside of the mainstream gaze or the mainstream of culture. And that is why, as a result, when thinking about 1970s Poland and this queer archive, it is important to remember about the specific privatization of homosexuality in socialist Poland. So because of the absence of the archive, in my work I did interviews with self-identified homosexual men, oral history interviews about their lives and their experiences, their memories of living in socialist Poland, focusing, of course, on the 1970s, on the long 70s, but also in each case following the biography of my interview partners, so also talking about their childhood, adolescent years, and also about their life later, after the transformation. So just to briefly characterize the group of that, my research group, the group of men that I've been conducting interviews, they all self-identify as homosexual men, born between 1936 and 1960, with the majority of them born in the 50s, so today 60 plus year old. And in the long 70s, all of them, despite the places that they were born in or spent their childhood years, they all were living in big cities, in Warsaw, Wrocław, and Poznań. So these are narratives about urban experiences. And they were active members of different male homosexual networks in those respective cities. So in that sense, these are narratives about success, in a way, because they were all part of some groups, some networks. And I had friends and partners in these circles. And most of my interview partners are very reluctant to embrace modern identity categories, such as gay or bisexual. And this is something that is very important for my project and for thinking about what to do with this archive, and I will come back to this point at the end, as well as to the point of their ambivalence or skepticism towards modern LGBTQ movements in Poland, and their reluctance to identity politics, to equality parades, or more generally to the growing visibility of homosexuality in media. So in my research, in these interviews that I conducted, in each case I was following I didn't have a list of prepared questions. I was always following the narrative and following the life trajectories of my interview partners. But of course, many common themes did appear in these interviews. So that I'm trying to organize these different individual voices and try to look at specifics. Not about specific, but about common themes. And some of them I've listed here. The one thing is the issue of self-identification as a homosexual person or identified same-sex desire, which my interview partners always see, and they talk about it as something that was natural, normal, that something that they discovered and they discovered in themselves, and then because of the silence and the invisibility of this of homosexuality in the public discourse, they had to discover it on themselves. They had to do the work of establishing who they are and what their lives will be by themselves. Another interesting theme that was quite common was a rejection of modern strategy of coming out. So a category that's very important for the contemporary LGBT movement, but for my interview partners was not something that was part of their experience. They often talked about the specific situation of not coming out to parents or close relatives, while at the same time being accepted by them, even up to the point of for example, going back to their homes for holidays with their partners, but never addressing the relationship openly. And for many years, for example, talking about their partners as friends and not as as someone closer to the lad. So this kind of specific functioning in a kind of open secret. Another common theme for them, another common theme of these interviews, because of the fact that they all lived in big cities, was the fact that moving to the big city, often to pursue studies or work, was at the same time the point of the time, the period of discovering the existence of homosexual networks and homosexual circles, communities. So this kind of visibility of discovering that what for many of them when they were younger was something that was only there. The identity suddenly becomes part of a community, and this is of course connected with stories and memories about cruising spaces and in cities, and also about different forms of socialities and friendships established by them. And this leads to another important context for these interviews, that my interview partners were forming this kind of emerging gay urban subcultures, or indeed a Polish queer culture that was not political yet, but that was, I think, a necessary step in the longer process of gay emancipation in Poland that, as I said, began in the political part of it began in the late 80s and most pronouncedly in the 1990s after the transformation. So of course an important question that arose during this research was the question, is there any common narrative or any grand narrative about the socialist male homosexual experience? And of course the question is that no, there is no one story. And in trying to organize and to work, think about these different and distinct stories and memories of lived experience, and because of the privatization of homosexuality, the fact that there was no political structures or organizations, that these are stories about private lives, I tried to look at about on this material by and try to organize it by looking at the different circles that they belonged to or did not belong to, and three circles seemed the most visible in their stories, in their memories. So kind of three networks of homosexual men meeting in cities. The first one, pikiety in Polish, which were the cruising spaces of public restroom, parks, railway stations. So this was the most kind of basic and popular way of meeting other men and kind of and experiencing this the visibility of homosexuality, that it was not restricted to any class of people, that it was something that was universal and in some way kind of democratic. The other circle were public bathhouses, which functioned, of course, in part as a cruising space, but also had also as a meeting place of kind of different generations. At least that is how many of my interview partners remember these places, that you could meet older homosexual men and kind of engage also in a shared history, or kind of look for traces of shared history. And then the third circle, which seems to me the most important when looking at the broader LGBTQ history in Poland, were the private apartments and the places where in the end they met, they organized parties, they formed friendships and a kind of a circle of friends and acquaintances. And some also talk about the kind of semi-institution of gay parlors, Salony Gejowskie, which were kind of these apartments that were also the place of for meeting, but were often hosted by some more renowned people who created a circle around them, and these people would meet often, you know, after kind of a theater play or after opera, and in that way kind of create their own social cultural practices. So I call this the apartment civilization, very specific for the 1970s, and because there were no public places outside of course the cruising spaces, but no public places to meet openly at least, then a lot of the social interactions and practices had to take place in the private sphere, in these apartments. And in these apartments, the emerging gay culture was established as a specific type of sociality, into which you had to be invited. You had to meet someone who would kind of take you inside the circle, where you not only met people who could become your partners or lovers, but also you took part in a bigger culture, looking for the traces of homosexuality in literature and films. In italics, the fragments in italics are fragments from the interview, from my interviews. So in these apartments, this gay culture that emerged was in very much is very much a testament to the fact that the idea that that socialist Poland and more broadly the communist bloc was isolated from Western Europe or the West is not true, because a lot of these narratives talk about, as the ones that are presented on screen, talk about looking at traces of homosexuality in cultural texts from the West. And of course, the circulation of ideas, of peoples, and of objects was able to move beyond the Iron Curtain or the Pink Curtain. So. So these are some of the main themes that emerged out of this archive of interviews that I conducted. And of course, one thing that is also important for me, especially now when the project is coming to an end, is to think about what this queer archive that was created in this way throughout by these interviews, and is a first step in recovering or reclaiming these private histories of everyday life. What is the status, or what is the function, or what is the importance of this queer archive? And when I'm thinking about it myself, there are two voices in my head. Try to organize this. The cultural anthropologist looks at this archive as the first step in reconstructing the still untold history of Polish homosexuality that has not yet been kind of written about in a larger extent, and that this specific experience and the specific period of time, the 1970s, are just a first step in this longer history that must be uncovered and that must be constructed. And because of the absence of materials, the kind of material archive from that period, the personal stories, the oral history, is very important in making sure that these lives and these experiences are not erased. So the cultural anthropologist looks at this archive as a way to organize and protect these stories, but also to expand it and include other voices, not only the homosexual men that I talked to, that I was able to reach, that agreed to talk to me, but also those who may feel more reluctant to share their experiences. And of course, looking outside of the male homosexuality, and other members of our team, of the Polish Crucif team, also work on voices of women, queer women, and trans people. So to kind of broaden this archive to not make it only a male-specific history. But then the queer scholar in me looks at this as with the question of what is the potential for this archive to also work as part of the larger queer politics. And these narratives about this pre-emancipation period in Polish queer history, I think, are significant because they talk about the experience of people living a queer life before the advent of gay politics in Poland and gay emancipation in Poland. And in that way, the fact that many of my interview partners are reluctant to adopt modern identity categories is a testament to the fact that this queering of male homosexuality may be an interesting point to, maybe an interesting perspective to look at this history. So, especially in the face of the kind of discontinuities and disconnections between different generations of queer people in Poland, and the differences on how the politics of then LG and now LGBTQ people in Poland differ between the socialist times, the 1970s, and then the 1990s and currently. So this archive is, in a way, can work as both a historical project and also a political project, but it needs to be expanded and also what I am very looking forward to today, also compared with other experiences from other countries, not only from the socialist bloc, but also to kind of work against this divide between the West and the East, which is perhaps very problematic in thinking about queer archives. So this is all that I wanted to say. Thank you all for listening.
Thank you very much. Very interesting to hear some new terms like the pink curtain, broadening our international context. Really admire the fact that you are interested in not finding one grand narrative as well. And I think the locating individual voices through oral testimony, that's one of the strengths of the methodologies. So it'll be interesting to hear how other people approach that as well. Our next speaker, Martha. Let me tell you a little bit about Martha. Martha's a second-year PhD student in history at the University of Birmingham. She's working on first queer oral history of multiple gender attraction and bisexuality in late 20th century Britain. Martha has previously researched multiple gender attraction in the 1970s gay lib movement and representations of bisexuality in the Gay News magazine. Martha is also, very importantly, the secretary for the UK's Oral History Society's Special Interests LGBT group, LGBTQ group, I think it is, without an I. But that's something
yeah,
we can talk
yeah.
to.
And also membership secretary. Not there's another there secretary who's more important yeah. than I have. But, the
Martha's paper, "It Wasn't So Much Changing My Sexuality as Sort of Activating It, Multiple Gender Attraction, Bisexuality and Oral History in the Past and Present." Please welcome Martha.
Thank you. Hi everyone. My name's Martha and I'm, as was said, in the second year of my PhD in modern British history at the University of Birmingham. And I just wanted to quickly say, firstly, how much I've enjoyed and learnt from this conference so far, and also that I feel kind of like an imposter as somebody who has zero archive or museums or galleries or whatever background. So my presentation is kind of as a user of archives and kind of a creator in that my oral histories will hopefully be archived, but I'm mostly talking about using archives in this. So my thesis is a queer oral history of bisexuality and multiple gender attraction, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s in Britain. The main source base for my thesis is interviews that I'm conducting myself with people who either identify as bisexual or who identify differently but have experienced attraction to more than one gender across their lifetime. I've so far conducted 16 interviews with 15 interviewees who were born between 1949 and 1971, and I'm aiming for about 15 to 20 interviews in total. I'm also using archival documents from gay liberation groups, the gay press, and the bisexual press from the time, which you can see on the PowerPoint slide, hopefully, and also listening to selected pre-existing oral history recordings from the Hall Carpenter Archives Oral History Project. And it's these pre-existing interviews and their relationship to my own interviews that I'll be focusing on in this paper. The Hall Carpenter Archives was founded in 1982, thanks to funding from the Greater London Council, and its oral history project began in 1985. Its stated aim was to record the life histories of gay men and lesbians, to recover what is, this is a quote, hidden, neglected or dismissed by the traditional focus of history, and to search for our past. In 1989, 4 years into the project, two books containing edited selections of 29 interviews were published, Walking After Midnight by the Gay Men's Oral History Group, and Inventing Ourselves by the Lesbian Oral History Group. In the same year, the Hall Carpenter Archives was forced to close due to a lack of funds. Its written documents were sent to the London School of Economics, where they still are, and its oral history recordings were given to the British Library Sound Archive, where they still are. The British Library then commissioned further interviews, which took place over the next 10 years. In total, 117 interviews were collected by the project between 1985 and 1999. Although there's been steadily increasing debate amongst oral historians about using pre-existing oral histories, there's often, I think, a sense of apology about doing so, perhaps an idea that it is a necessary evil as a result of limitations to budgets or time, or to fill gaps in your own research. And my initial engagement with the Hall Carpenter Oral Histories was also, I can now admit, less out of genuine historical curiosity than it was a desire to feel or appear productive while waiting for my project to pass a very long ethical review process so I could begin the real work of conducting my own interviews. In the rest of this paper, I'll discuss the practice of using pre-existing oral history interviews in the specific context of queer history and the history of multiple gender attraction. Although there have been many challenges, using the Hall Carpenter interviews has proven far more productive than my initial pessimistic expectations. So firstly, I'll discuss the most obvious problem with using pre-existing interviews, which is that future researchers might not have a full understanding of the interview's original context. Adette Parry and Natasha Mortner, for example, argue that subsequent researchers do not have the same knowledge about the context of the original data collection to the extent that it becomes impossible to draw meaningful conclusions. Martin Hammersley similarly argues that the original researcher has a unique relationship to the primary data and that this cannot be replicated elsewhere. In many ways, my own experience with the Hall Carpenter interviews echoed some of these concerns. I was able to access tape recordings of the interviews and read archive descriptions which usually, although not always, stated the names of the interviewer and interviewee, the date of the interview, and gave a brief description of the topics covered. However, I found myself with questions about the interview context that it was impossible to answer. Although the books I mentioned before described the aims of the project as being about recovery, I wanted to know how those aims informed the recruitment of interviewees and the formulation of research questions. Writing about the use of pre-existing community oral histories, Abigail Knight, Julia Brannan and Rebecca O'Connell talk about the difficulty of accessing, as outsiders, the shared local knowledge of the original interviewers and interviewees. In the case of the Hall Carpenter interviews, the interviewer sometimes appeared to know a lot of background detail about the interviewee's life, or know some of the people mentioned by the interviewee, and in some instances, the interviewer and interviewee appeared to have already been acquaintances or friends. However, I had no way of confirming this or knowing what discussion had preceded the interview. Even oral historians who generally present more positive assessments of the use of pre-existing oral histories, such as April Galway on the Millennium Memory Bank or Malin Thor Turaby on the Jewish Memories Collection, acknowledge the problem posed to later researchers by their inevitable gaps in contextual knowledge. Both Turaby and Galway attempted to overcome this by interviewing people who had been involved in the original creation of the project to ask about their influences and their motives. However, this is not always possible. although the Hall Carpenter Archives Oral History Project had a paid employee who conducted most of the interviews, the project itself was organised into a lesbian oral history group and a gay men's oral history group. The emphasis on collective decision-making and collective ownership of the project, so often a hallmark of 1970s and 1980s sources, meant that the individual members of these groups were often anonymous. Furthermore, in the specific context of interviews with the lesbian and gay community in the 1980s and 1990s, we have to be conscious of the shadow cast by the AIDS epidemic over these sources. While AIDS, on the one hand, informed the project's desire to collect life histories while there was still time, it's also tragically constrained our ability to speak to original members of the project and to find out about their approaches firsthand. So while acknowledging then the frustrations and uncertainties that come with a contextual distance from the original project, I think it's necessary, particularly as scholars of queer history, to find a more positive argument about using pre-existing oral histories that doesn't revolve solely around mitigating drawbacks. Although the differences between my position as a researcher in the 21st century and the context of the original interviews in the 1980s and 1990s pose difficulties, they also have benefits. One of the most important of these is that the different temporal contexts mean I have several different windows into the period I'm studying. Firstly, of course, the Hall Carpenter interviewees are remembering the 20th century, including the 1970s and 1980s, which is the period I'm particularly interested in. Secondly, as the interviews were conducted in the 1980s and 1990s, they are themselves a primary source that provide an insight into the late 20th century context. There is then the additional temporal context of 2018 and 2019, the context in which I'm interpreting the Hall Carpenter interviews, as well as the context in which I'm conducting and interpreting my own interviews. My own interviewees explicitly acknowledged the ways in which the present-day context informed their recollections. An example of this is when several interviewees discussed the debates over reform of the Gender Recognition Act concerning trans rights in the UK, and they often compared it to their memories of the 1980s. So, for example, Alison likened rhetoric around trans people to the stigmatisation of gay people during Section 28, while Lisa compared the transphobia that's going around now to the lesbian sex wars of the 1980s over SM and pornography, which she retrospectively dismissed as ridiculous. The cyclical view of history that these interviewees presented is an interesting juxtaposition to interviews to the Hall Carpenter interviews conducted in the 1980s, which were directly affected by the context of the AIDS epidemic, Section 28, and the so-called lesbian sex wars. Related to the different temporal contexts is the question of age and generation. Nguyen Tan Hoang has discussed the importance of intergenerational queer pedagogy and the processes by which queer experience gets transmitted from one generation to the next. However, these intergenerational relationships are complex and often difficult to achieve. For example, Glenda Russell and Janice Bohan argue that various factors, including socialising that is often age-segregated, premature death from AIDS and suicide, fears around paedophilia, and the fact that many LGBTQ people were unable to have children, mean that connections between older and younger generations are more fragmented and remote than for the general population. This is often used as an argument for the study of LGBTQ history, especially conducting oral history interviews. However, I would also argue that it demonstrates the importance of using pre-existing oral histories and comparing these to new interviews. My own interviewees, whose ages range from 47 to 70, often reflected on the generational differences between myself and them as a way to convey change over time. In some cases, this was a positive change. For example, Ossian, born in 1954, who had been part of GLF, told me that he thought the millennials of today were the heirs to GLF's political work without the baggage that GLF members had experienced, which had prevented them from being fully liberated. Nigel, born in 1963, also said that young people today find coming out much easier to do, but he saw this in a slightly more negative sense, arguing that this ease was because of a generational ignorance about the AIDS epidemic that he had lived through, and said, "I get the feeling now the younger generation don't even know what the AIDS crisis was." As with my interviewees' reflections on the present social and political moment, these generational comparisons also give me an understanding of popular memory. It is helpful and interesting to analyse how the late 20th century is viewed from the context of 2018 and 2019. At the same time, interviews that were conducted in the 1980s and 1990s also provide essential further context and scope for comparison. Similarities between earlier interviews and those conducted in the present show continuity, and help establish closer intergenerational relationships, while differences between them help to highlight the ways in which contexts have changed. As well as generational differences between myself as an interviewer and my interviewees, there were also noticeable differences within my interview cohort. These differences were most stark between those interviewees who were born in the early 1950s and those born in the 1960s. Many of my female interviewees, born before 1955, continued to identify as lesbian, although they had been in relationships with men in the past. So, for example, Judith said that this was because of the politics surrounding it, and said that in the 1980s she had described herself as a lesbian who happens to be sleeping with a man at the moment. Although initially surprising to me, this perspective was also reflected by some of the Hall Carpenter interviewees, born around the same time in the 1940s and early 1950s. For example, Diane, born in 1941, said that she explicitly identified as lesbian, even when she was in a relationship with her husband, saying, "He knew that I was a lesbian or had had relationships with women as well." The interviewer seemed perplexed by this and asked her about the process of changing your sexuality after the breakup of her marriage, but Diane was very clear. "It wasn't so much changing my sexuality as sort of activating it. I felt I was already a lesbian, so I didn't have to come out so much from that point of view." The similarities in lesbian identity between my interviewees born in the 1950s and the Hall Carpenter interviewees born in the 1940s and 1950s show that these issues are particularly resonant for that sub-generation. If I could only analyse information from the interviews I've conducted myself, the limited source base would make it harder to draw out broader conclusions about the relevance of age and generation in this. I would therefore argue that while the differing temporal context of the Hall Carpenter interviews and my own can be frustrating, as Parry and Mortner and others argue, these different contexts also provide unique and significant advantages. The changing attitudes to lesbian identity amongst women who experience multiple gender attraction leads me to another issue about using pre-existing oral histories, which concerns identity. Joanna Bornack discusses this in relation to the ethical issues of using pre-existing oral histories for a different purpose. She writes that in the context of interviews about medicine, that the interviewees consented to take part in the interviews and agreed to depositing their tapes and transcripts in the public archive because they believed, quite correctly, that the focus of the interview had been their professional lives as physicians, end quote. She wonders whether her approach to examine these interviews for discussions of race is an ethical violation, although at the same time she also points out that this is not considered an issue with large data sets where statistics are the focus and the data are seen as more scientific than personal. In my own work, the ethical dilemma concerns my use of multiple gender attraction and bisexuality as categories of analysis. Using the Hall Carpenter interviews with this in mind feels limiting in a very literal sense. Out of the 117 interviews, I listened to 23. These were selected on the basis of an online search of the archive descriptions for the words bisexual, bi, marriage, married, boyfriend or girlfriend, husband or wife to find partners of different gender to the interviewee, and label to find general discussion of labels and identities. I was not just seeking instances where bisexuality was explicitly named, but also examples which would enable me to investigate the ways in which relationships with people of various genders were discussed. This archive search function, however, felt like a blunt tool to capture this nuance and relied on archive descriptions that were of varying length and quality. Only one of the Hall Carpenter interviewees, Dave, explicitly identified as bisexual, and even he added a caveat saying, "I've never really allied myself with one definition other than sexual, or at a pinch I would have to say bisexual, and then sort of qualify that immediately. I believe Freud was right when he said that all human beings are innately bisexual." Many other interviewees explicitly rejected the term. Betty, for example, said that, "I never have thought that bisexuality was an option, really." And Liz said that bisexuality didn't make any sense to me, it wasn't about that. It was about that I had this very, very strong relationship with this particular man. Listening to these statements was an instance in which my use of pre-existing oral history interviews was deeply frustrating. I listened to the interviewer move on to discuss other issues without pressing further into the areas of silence about which I had so many questions. Why did Betty not consider bisexuality to be an option? What did Liz mean by "it wasn't about that"? However, these statements also posed an ethical dilemma. Clearly, describing these women as bisexual would be offensive and inaccurate when they so clearly rejected the label themselves. I developed the term multiple gender attraction in an effort to include situations such as this, where people did not identify as bisexual but had been attracted to or had relationships with multiple genders across their lifetime. These women generally did talk about the attraction they had felt towards their previous male partners, so I don't think this was solely the result of compulsory heterosexuality. So, for example, Liz said that her strong relationship was characterised by affection and a really strong caring, and Betty said that she was very fond of her male partner and things had been going well. and other interviewees who also said similar things. However, they still explicitly rejected bisexuality. Liz also connected this rejection of bisexuality to her work with incest survivors in the early 1980s, which she said made it difficult for her to sustain a sexual relationship with her partner due to her increasingly critical analysis of heterosexuality as an institution and how it currently functions. She again emphasised that this was not a reflection on her partner's individual character and said they would probably be friends forever, but she didn't want to live like that. These thorough and politicised rejections of bisexuality and relationships with men, despite having had positive relationships with men in the past, therefore made me question whether it was appropriate to include these interviewees in my analysis of multiple gender attraction. Even as I had sought to avoid ethical dilemmas by creating the term multiple gender attraction, it's increasingly seemed that even using these interviews for my own project has ethical implications which are impossible to neatly resolve. However, again, in the interests of moving away from the typical negative or apologetic narratives about the use of pre-existing oral histories, I want to highlight some of the advantages of these dilemmas over identity. Firstly, of course, it has made me more conscious of the implications, even of terms intended to be straightforwardly descriptive, such as multiple gender attraction. This has led me to more detailed and specific analysis of discourses about attraction and relationships, and how they are discussed in my own interviews and the pre-existing oral histories in a way that clearly separates attraction from identity. Secondly, as the possibility of bisexuality was being rejected by these interviewees, the meaning of bisexuality was also being constructed, albeit in ways which were necessarily unclear and partial. By contrasting bisexuality to her very, very strong relationship with this particular man, Liz may have been suggesting that bisexuality was associated with shallow or weak relationships. The use of this particular man might alternatively suggest that bisexuality was being defined as an all-encompassing or indiscriminate attraction, whereas her feelings were particular to one individual. Betty's description of bisexuality as not an option was even more opaque. In the wider context of her discussion, however, it becomes slightly clearer. She was reflecting on her continuing feelings of fondness towards her male partner and her difficulty in understanding how you were meant to juggle that with her feminist politics and her involvement in women's aid groups. This could therefore suggest that bisexuality was being characterised as an insufficiently political identity, or one separate from feminist politics, in such a way that it provided no useful means of reconciling these politics with a relationship with a man. These insights were helpful in demonstrating the ideas about bisexual and lesbian identity that were prevalent in the 1980s and early 1990s. Some of my own interviewees, conscious of the fact that I was interviewing them for a project on bisexuality and multiple gender attraction, may have felt more reluctant to appear critical of bisexuality. So, for example, Judith said that she identified as lesbian rather than bisexual because of the politics surrounding it, but when I asked follow-up questions about her understanding of bisexual politics in relation to lesbian politics, she emphasised that it's not that I'm less keen on bisexual politics and probably just a product of my time. Comparing Judith, who was born in 1954, with the Hall Carpenter examples born at a similar time, shows that she was to a large extent a product of her time, in that her attitudes were similar to those of other women born in the 1940s and early 1950s. However, Judith and my other interviewees were also a product of the 21st century context, and being able to compare them to interviews conducted in the time period I'm researching is invaluable in helping to understand in which ways discourses about sexuality have changed and remained consistent over time. In conclusion, the interviews I've listened to from the Hall Carpenter Collection have presented me with practical and ethical problems in ways that are often particular to the study of bisexuality and multiple gender attraction. However, they've also demonstrated the importance of time, life cycles, and politics in constructing discourses about sexual identities. Although I began listening to these interviews as a way to kill time and feel like I was being a productive historian, the use of pre-existing oral history archives has opened up an incredibly important area of comparison that's crucial to my research. Thank you.
Thank you, Martha. Lots to unpack there, actually, and we'll do it in our questions afterwards. It strikes me, one thing that came to mind is that we don't often give our communities opportunities to use the recordings from other generations in group situations where we can respond to them. And another thing that struck me as well was how important interviewer profiles are. how often do we write down key words and the profile of the person we're interviewing, but don't say what context we're coming from. So really interesting, look forward to talking to you more. Okay, third speaker, Jonathan Katz. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
He's an activist, an art historian, educator, writer, and curator, and co-founder of Queer Nation San Francisco. He's the founder of the Harvey Milk Institute in the USA, the largest queer studies institute in the world. He was the first artistic director of National Queer Arts Festival in San Fran and has published widely in the United States and Europe. He's currently a visiting professor at the University of Pennsylvania. And on a side note, he's curated an exhibition that's open at the moment until August 30th called About Face, Stonewall Revolt and New Queer Art. It has 500 works in it. It's huge. It's in Chicago. It's at the Wrightwood
659. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's got rave reviews. Jonathan's paper, Pop Art is Queer, the previously unheard queer content of Andy Warhol's 1964 interview. Just when you thought there was something that you couldn't, more that you couldn't find out about Andy Warhol. I'm very excited. Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's a mistake to think that queer history has been censored. By definition, censoring foregrounds the intent to control what is seen and understood. You know when you've been censored. But we don't know what's happened to the vast bulk of our histories. It's been purged, eradicated, redacted, an invisible, imposed silencing transformed into an absence. And only very, very rarely does this process reverse itself. But in the case of Andy Warhol, it has. Andy Warhol's interview in What is Pop Art, part of the famous series of artist interviews conducted by Gene Swenson in 1963, is the source of some of the most famous Warhol quotes of all time. But as a superb doctoral student at the University of Chicago named Jen Sichel has argued in her recent groundbreaking article in the Oxford Art Journal, we have a notably skewed relationship to what Warhol actually said. Jen managed to find and transcribe the entire original interview with Swenson and published excerpts of the tapes in her March 2018 article. I'm entirely indebted to her. But as I'm about to demonstrate through the discovery of these tapes, we can literally resuscitate ideas that were deliberately excised from this early and defining interview. Here, Warhol says famously, for the first time, I think everybody should be a machine. He also says, another famous quote, I think everybody should like everybody. Indispensable utterances that have over the years sustained many critical arguments regarding, for example, Warhol, pop, and indeed postmodernism in general. But the interview was cut by the magazine's editors so that it's in its published form, every single reference to homosexuality or queerness was ruthlessly edited out. The published transcripts actually spliced together different conversations into a false whole. And with the discovery of these unedited tapes, we now have the perfect instance of really coming to understand the deep connection between Warhol's homosexuality and his aesthetics. Now, they're hard to understand, these tapes, at first. So as I play you one of the sections, and I will show you a slide that allows you to see the words. We pick them up at the beginning, and as you'll see, the tape literally opens with a direct question, what do you say about homosexuals? But immediately, Swenson and Warhol's friend and assistant Gerard Malanga reframe that question into the arch and ironic terms of then-contemporary gay speech, turning it into a kind of campy critique of the masculinist presumptions of abstract expressionism. Listen, as he turns the painter Norman Bloom into Norma, Michael Goldberg into Michelle, even Karp into Ava, all notably sort of macho art world types. As you'll see, at first Warhol happily plays along, but I want to call your attention to that rare non-affirmation in Warhol's speech. A brief, no, I'm. It's the beginning of an objection to the familiar way they're playing with sexuality, and he will, as you'll soon see, revisit and amplify this extremely rare negation into something that will become the fulcrum of this talk. Can you hear it?
Oh, you have to ask me a really quick. No, I'm positive it's homosexual.
That's not working. Why are we not getting sound? Is this on?
Yeah, it's on. Maybe you can try again. You can try again.
Okay, let's give it another shot.
What do you say about homosexuals? Oh, you have to ask me a leading question. Do you know a lot of closet queens who are homosexuals? Who are expressionists? Yes.
It's full.
Who are these girls?
Michelle Goldberg.
Really?
Fantastic.
Who else?
Al Leonard.
Norma Bloom.
Norma Bloom?
Yeah. Iron Carr.
Eva Carr.
Eva Carr.
The unedited interview reveals that in 1963, questions of sexuality were hardly incidental to the discourse on pop, but front and center. And deliberately so, since, as Warhol says a bit later on, right, in responding to Swenson's indignation over homophobia in the art world, I think the whole interview on me should just be on homosexuality. Swenson, then a critic, writer, and curator, just beginning his career in the New York art world, had reason to believe that this line of inquiry would receive a warm reception from Warhol. That same year, in fact, Warhol completed a series of erotically tinged drawings of the critic, concentrating on his sensuous lips and tongue. Tellingly, Warhol's early softcore images of young men, mostly his lovers or would-be lovers, are almost never shown today. This is especially the case with the more hardcore imagery from an enormous series of cock portraits completed for his proposed multi-volume cock book. At the Tanager Gallery in 1956, 63 years ago, Warhol proposed an exhibition of boys kissing with that title. It was to be called Boys Kissing. It was a remarkably boldly political move in the mid-50s, and Warhol was surely not surprised when the exhibition was, of course, rejected. This is the image of it. Wait, am I behind? Do you have boys kissing? No, sorry. There you go. There we go. But Warhol proposed such an exhibition, at once defined, politicized, and boldly dissident, at the time when homosexuality was quite literally illegal, is telling, not least because it was over a decade before any national queer civil rights movement in the United States. The roots of what Warhol became can be traced to this moment, as is, I think, beautifully exemplified by this 1956 drawing, which would be recycled in 1969 into this, Warhol's famous cover for the Rolling Stones' Sticky Fingers album from 1971. Hardly marginal, this was the album that rocketed the Stones from popular to legendary. Yet addressing Warhol's queerness brings to bear important historical nuances, for there are no less than three distinct modes of queerness visible in this work. The first two we readily recognize and call out as such. One features, of course, homoerotic images of young men. This is his 1956 reclining nude, and it conforms exactly to what cultural expectations of a gay art should look like. And it was singularly unsuccessful in circulating beyond the relatively small group of gay men, more or less, who found it enticing. Another model of gayness on offer, not nearly so inward-turning and insular, instead turned on dominant culture and addressed itself to dominant culture, indeed manifested its queer bona fides only through reference to the non-queer world. I'm showing you, of course, Marilyn Monroe's lips. This, too, of course, is a familiar mode of queerness, subjecting dominant culture to a judgmental queer eye and a withering tongue, elevating discernment and taste as its weapons. Camp is its primary mode, the recognition that what passes for the natural in our culture is in fact always a social construct, a semiotics of the natural, as evidenced in Monroe's Lips. This latter model is in many respects the obverse of the earnestness of Warhol's original nudes. It's instead arch, excessive, ironic, the very definition of camp. And unlike that other model, it's a subcultural formation that not only promotes an engagement with dominant culture, but speaks its language, referencing its codes, all the while critiquing and internalizing its standards. I trust I don't need to belabor the point about why a faggy kid like Andy Warhol might find a certain pleasure in revealing the ostensibly natural category of gender as instead an artifact of the social. The third model of queerness in Warhol is the most elusive, largely because it violates the defining norms of gayness as a product of subcultural identity. This last mode is what is finally made plain in the recovered interview, but it has been evidenced in his art all along, hiding in plain sight. The very earliest work of Warhol in this nascent pop style can be seen as a transition from this previous recognizably gay model of minority erotics, such as the boy drawings, towards this other, what would become pop art mode. It's what made him perhaps the most famous artist of the last half of the 20th century, yet it has been noticeably resistant to queer readings. The question of how and why Warhol's art switched from either markers of subculture, as in his male nudes or camp quotations, to this other third mode, a wholesale embrace of popular culture, I'm showing you his 210 Coke bottles, has not been fully explored nor explained. The value of that switch for Warhol is self-evident. It made Warhol Warhol. And in what follows, I'm going to try to illustrate how a turn to the archive can rewrite one of the world's most often exhibited artists, explaining Warhol's abandonment of a manifestly gay art in favor of what would become his much more queer pop mode. In turning to the rediscovered interview, we can secure a better sense of what Warhol himself understood as the import of the relationship between sexuality and art. For he says unambiguously, in a statement notable for the time, "I want that on my interview." Oops. I'm not getting well, we'll do this one. So when they finally get down to business, they first play the relationship between pop and queerness for laughs. Swenson's strikingly frank question, "Do you think pop art is queer?" becomes a joke. But very quickly, as the camp tone threatens to color the entire interview, Warhol begins to push back. And that's unusual. Why Warhol pushing back? More than that, he valiantly tries to redirect the conversation and is, for him, strikingly insistent in doing so. He deploys a string of negations. "No, can't, it should be different." Such constructions are highly unusual in the context of Warhol's usual reflexive affirmation. And what he is contesting, as you're about to discover, is the idea of gayness as the opposite of straightness. In place of this polarity, Warhol articulates a call for a universal polymorphous perversity, or what Warhol would articulate rather simply as liking. Oops, damn it. Why am I having trouble here?
Okay, well, then let's start. What do you know about homosexuals? And have you ever met a homosexual?
Did your tan represent a penis?
No, it can't be like
that. I understand a New York homosexual is slightly homosexual.
The crust of the middle class.
No, it has to be on a different... It should be a different way than, you know, just sort of like...
Different than direct.
Yeah.
Once he can get a word in edgewise amidst all this campy banter, Warhol's redirection turns on the obvious fact that not all pop artists are gay. So it's not an artist's sexuality that makes pop queer, it's an attitude. What Warhol is trying to get at here, so insistently, is a new idea about sexuality, new for its time. It's contained in his twinned ideas of liking and machines, and you're about to see this right here.
It has to be sort of some bad idea about that all pop artists aren't homosexual. And it really doesn't matter. You know, that the artist does that. And everybody should be a machine. And everybody should be, I don't understand the business stuff. If all pop artists are not homosexual, what does this have to do with being a machine?
Well, I think everybody should like everybody.
We should like both men and women.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sexually and in every way.
Yeah.
And that's what pop art's about.
Yeah.
It's liking things. And liking things is being like a machine.
Yeah.
Well, because you do the same thing every time. You do the same thing over and over again. And you do human sex.
Yeah.
And everything you do.
What Warhol is trying to get at here is an attitude. He's trying to talk insistently about a new idea about sexuality, seeking to define an automatic, reflexive, absolute, which is to say, machine-like, process of liking. This is a form of liking that is automatic, unmediated. It refuses received opinion. What Swenson, in his brilliant 1966 essay, The Other Tradition, actually referred to as evolutionary thinking, because evolutionary thinking is taxonomic. It puts everything in a place, in an a priori teleological trajectory. Swenson's target in that essay is formless art history. But I think he gets this idea from Warhol and Pop, likely from this very interview, with its notion of liking as the undoing of existing categories. Notably, here Warhol is trying out a very different vision of sexuality than the one that animated either his early boy drawings or his campy pop mode, the sort of early images of Liz and company. And it's, of course, very different from the very campy gossip his friends were then auditioning all around him. To like both men and women, sexually and in every other way, is to dislodge sexuality as a key marker of social difference, and thus, of course, of social discrimination. This decidedly isn't bisexuality, as that remains a marker of identity associated with sexuality. Rather, what Warhol seems to try to articulate here is an automated, machine-like process of liking. This necessarily entails the abandonment of any extant model of sexuality, where liking is motivated by identity constructs. Such identity constructs can be understood, in Swenson's terms, as mere evolutionary thinking, as a way of pigeonholing us into affinities that we know in advance of any actual encounter. But resolutely anti-hierarchical, Warhol's sweeping affirmations are a vote in favor of the horizontal, not vertical, social order. And that horizontal sociality turns on the valuation of surface over depth, for deep or felt liking segregates us from one another, while machine-like liking flattens our differences and aggregates us together. Warhol's pop mode is a visual argument in favor of this widescreen approbation, figuring as it does a range of real-life products, peoples, and situations, some deeply disturbing, such as the disaster series, some satisfying, but all notably resistant to clear definition and existing taxonomies. Warhol here is looking to promote an unmediated, automatic, in-the-moment encounter that flees the demand for definition, that refutes the necessary classifications for both us and that which we're looking for. And here you can see some of the many edits required to turn Warhol's complex statement about sexuality into these famous impersonal claims that we now know and cite today. But as gayness first began to politicize its difference from dominant culture, a minoritizing model, I hasten to add, that grew up in the context of overt discrimination, judicial terror, and mandatory self-denial as a means of negotiating homophobic horror, Warhol prescribes not coming out, but the very opposite, an anti-identitarian turn away from subjective depth and classified desire. Yet the self-reifying coming out model of gay identity would, at the end of this decade, instead become the very model of the gay liberation movement, seized upon and ridden to great political success. And its central tenet was that the world was actually divided between queer and straight people in a clear and largely binary opposition. But here, long before gay liberation discourse was a political reality, Warhol is trying another tack. He is describing, I hope the point by now is obvious, what we mean when we use the word queer today, a marked refusal to consent to the notion that sexual desires constitute a meaningful field of social difference. Rather than reinforcing an essentializing paradigm of sexuality, his new model actually draws strength from the empirical fact that pop artists are not all actually gay. Warhol's new idea of sexuality is premised not on gay and lesbian difference, but rather on its concerted and deliberate erasure. And pop art is exhibit A in that argument, evidence that our manifold commonalities supersede, indeed swamp, whatever residual differences we have, differences that we flatter ourselves as uniquely our own, despite the fact that they are but the result of a social script. Warhol's term for sexuality here is liking. And he uses it, and as he uses it, liking is a political mode, a mode without discriminations in every sense of that word. In pointed contrast to gay constructs that define sexuality as within a person, an aspect of their innermost core and character, in this model, liking isn't deep, it isn't essential, it isn't individual, it's automated, machine-like, because that's what machines do, processing things automatically with neither desire nor will. Admittedly, this is a particularly queer kind of queer liberation, premised as it is on the elimination of sexuality as a field of meaningful difference, a newly consecrated social good to the degree that it eliminates the isolated, hierarchical, or painful, excluded nature of gayness. Warhol suggests that the proper response to a homophobic world isn't to consecrate your differences, but to evaporate them. Not by denying your sexuality, but rather by denying sexuality as a meaningful aspect of social difference. So when Warhol paints 210 Coke bottles in 1962, as he would later write in his autobiography, A to B Back Again, invoking this vision of new, undifferentiated communality, one premised not on difference, but on sameness, not on isolation, but communion, Warhol wrote about Coke the following. You can be watching TV, I'm quoting him here, and see Coca-Cola, and you know that the president drinks Coke, Liz Taylor drinks Coke, and just think you can drink a Coke too. A Coke is a Coke, and no amount of money can get you a better Coke than the one the bum on the corner is drinking. All the Cokes are the same, and all the Cokes are good. Liz Taylor knows it, the president knows it, the bum knows it, and you know it. End quote. To argue that 210 Coke bottles is a queer painting, as I'm now doing, is thus to redistribute the meaning and weight of sexuality from the individual to the collective and the communal, so close to our contemporary queer dream. In the Swenson interview, Warhol's trying to put into words this different framing of sexuality, one that is dedicated not to the establishment of its difference from dominant culture, but its contiguity with it. In his famous Pan to the Machine, Warhol was searching for a mode of social engagement that kept individuality, interiority, identity, even taste at bay, that sought instead to build bridges across our differences. It's one thing to show an audience a recognizable gayness, one that resonates with all our already existing thinking. It's another thing entirely to queer parasitically, a shifting construct that refutes, decenters, or tears apart any coherent vision of what queerness is or should be like. In queering, we need to be attentive to how queerness can and does escape the forms we readily recognize. To both like something and at the same time critique that liking isn't a contradiction in terms, it's an acknowledgement of how we live. As Warhol once said, and I quote him here, "The more you look at the exact same thing, the more the meaning goes away." That's the best definition of queer liberation I know. Thank you.
That was so interesting. Thank you, Jonathan. Let's make like Coke bottles and find a commonality between these papers and all our work. Shall we take some chairs? I need to give you a little possibly notice. There's lots of police around. There's police in the Brandenburg Gate, Tiergarten, etc. They're here for the authorised trade union demonstration today of tens of thousands of people. The main theme of the demonstration is social justice. Some of the police have been coming in to use the bathrooms here because we're so close. So the organisers have wanted you to know that they're here for the street march as a matter of routine and equally have nothing to do with us. So just so you know, that's why they're here. They're not here policing us necessarily.
Maybe some of us.
Do you know what I mean? It depends how you look, really. Okay, so let me open up after these fascinating papers. Let me open up the conversation to you. Who would like to kick us off? Great.
I would like to actually start with your talk, Jonathan, and ask you about this parasitic queerness. And could you also run through the evolutionary thinking? I kind of missed that step in your argument. There's a lot more I want to ask about the overarching thrust here, but could I just have a clarification for you?
Sure. I guess what I was trying to do in this paper is to take account of the fact that Warhol initially comes out as a very clearly gay artist according to terms that we readily recognize. And he recognized, no dummy that he was, that it was going nowhere. So he looks for an alternative model of articulating sexual difference that isn't reinforcing an essentialized vision of gay difference. And what pop then becomes, for him, I'm arguing, I mean, he says it flat out, pop art is queer, right? Is this model of sexuality that turns on a machine-like liking of everything so that notions of difference and different likings no longer matter. And that then becomes the field of a new kind of queer liberation premised not on our differences but our commonalities. Did that make sense?
Yeah, and the evolutionary thinking?
Oh, well, you mean as Swenson was using it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, sorry.
I know that from Bergson.
Yeah, no. So what?
Okay,
what? It's the same. He's using the same kind of reference. So what Swenson is doing in this amazing 1964 exhibition, which is called The Other Tradition, and it's all about not believing in formalism as the root of art history, mm-hmm. but emotion. And what he says is, we approach art history with an evolutionary sensibility where we want to slot taxonomically everything into its bright category. But what we don't notice is that emotionally, things constantly cross back and forth.
Okay. So I'm wondering, what about the philic, which could be belonging with the liking, but also to a kind of fetishistic or pathologizing tradition? And would you then suggest that is, it's not like a polymorphous perversity where everything is possibly attachable, but has this more evacuation, machinic, decentralizing the subject. I'm just kind of wondering.
Yeah, no, you're really, what you're doing is really weighing the ethics of this, I think,
yeah.
Right? And what I would say is, I think we have the luxury at our moment of adjudicating it ethically, but what we're seeing here, remember, is something from 1962, right? Somebody trying to find another way to think through queerness that would not entail a reinforcement of a minoritized identity. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, I think it's evidence of the success of our movement that we can even ask the kinds of questions you now seek to ask.
I would like to ask from the Polish colleague, how many interviews have you conducted, and were all interviews were conducted by you? And what is the difference of you know, a research project and this archive project? I mean, you refer to this as part of a bigger archive project, but I missed it. But I think you haven't. At least I haven't heard you contextualize this, what makes it an archive project. So will you have a special way of disseminating it? Are these accessible? If mm-hmm. they are, how? So I would like to know mm-hmm. more about these practical details. Thank you.
Yes, my research is part of the Crusaf project of the Polish, because this is an international project that's taking place in four countries, and in Poland we have a whole team. And it's multidisciplinary, so it's not only oral history interviews. We also have people working on literature, on art, and art history. And among the team, there are a couple of people who are doing interviews, not only me. There's also Magda Staroszczyk, who's here, who's talking about her research on Thursday on the first panel about women. So there's a group of us. I myself have done 15 interviews with these men, and did I answer all your questions?
How's it getting out?
We're now ending the project in the final stages, and we have collected quite a lot of these interviews, and now we are working on. We have them all, of course, recorded and also transcribed,
mm-hmm.
and now we're looking for a place to. To make them at the same time accessible to other researchers, but at the same time, of course, because of the kind of delicate nature of many of these interviews, to still protect the interviewees. So, and this is not an easy task, and there are not that many archives in Poland of these type of historical sources. So it's not that we can so easily join our archive into an already existing one.
Do you fear it being misused?
Yeah, well, that's what we are trying to make sure that it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, we are not making these interviews accessible to all because.
Did you ask them? I mean, obviously you had some sort of understanding with the interviewees. You know, how you can use your.
Yes, of course they. They all signed agreements that these materials, the interviews, will be used by us in academic context. But
it doesn't always solve the problem of just the person's consent, though, does it?
No, because of course, I mean, if you don't know how you will use it or how you will, make it accessible, how can you agree with that? I think the only solution is. This is what I heard from a visual anthropologist friend who has actually produced a documentary sort of anthropological collection that she asked for a consent which covered everything, but then it's so difficult to get that sort of consent because you cannot know what will happen, especially if I don't know whether these were just audio interviews or videos as well.
Only audio.
Because that's also even more complicated.
Yes, and I also feel like bringing that type of concept that we're talking about would make it even harder to find people who would agree.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was also, of course, a big problem for us to find a lot of people. A lot of people disagreed, rejected our didn't want to share their stories.
And there are three other countries where they are, other countries?
The UK, Spain and Germany.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then over to you. I have a question for Martha. I found myself thinking, when I was thinking about your subjects, some of the subjects' disinclination to identify themselves as bisexual, about the kind of anxiety-inducing figure of the, scare quotes, duplicitous bisexual in the 80s and 90s in the context of the AIDS crisis. And I wondered whether that might be shaping their disinclination to name themselves as bisexual, and whether that was something you'd spoken to any of them about.
Yeah, so there's, I suppose, kind of two aspects to it, in that there was some of my interviewees who didn't want to identify as bisexual, and then there was also the Paul Carpenter interviewees who generally didn't want to identify as bisexual. Amongst my interviewees, there wasn't many, because the whole interview sample is not that big, but they generally said that it was about politics, it was about feminism. There weren't any men that I interviewed who had not identified as bisexual in the 70s and 80s, but by the time I interviewed them, they identified as bisexual or pansexual or queer, kind of generally. It was three or four women who I've interviewed who were all in that slightly older age bracket who still identify as lesbian, or one of them as kind of gay or lesbian. And they all, I asked them about it, or they generally said unprompted, because they kind of knew what what the interview was about. And they said, it's about feminism, it's about kind of connecting to feminism, that stuff, it's about politics and stuff. They didn't reference AIDS in that at all. Other interviewees who now identify as bisexual did say that they had trouble kind of doing that in the 80s because of AIDS. So I think that was definitely a factor. It's just less of a factor today, I guess.
It's really interesting.
Yeah, and the interview sample is small enough that it's kind of hard to make any broad conclusions. In the Paul Carpenter interviews, because they weren't kind of about bisexuality like at all, they were about gay and lesbian identity, they weren't asked why they identified the way they did. So again, there were women who talked about it being generally didn't talk about that much at all, but those that did kind of connected it again to politics, lesbian, feminism. There was one man who explicitly said that he didn't identify as bisexual, but that was kind of, he was saying that it was because he was oppressed by the gay side of bisexual, he was the straight side of me isn't oppressed, the gay side of me is oppressed, so I want to identify with that. So again, kind of a political thing, and AIDS wasn't really mentioned in that context. So I think it probably did play a role in the 80s and maybe 90s, but in terms of the actual interviews that I've looked at, it was more of a political thing.
It highlights precisely why the older materials are so valuable, though, because you can see these social shifts, can't you? Particularly when it's sort of multi-generational as well. And yet we still have why invisibility, but it seems to be for different reasons. Really interesting. Your question.
Hi, I'm Pierrette Squires. I'm based at Bolton Museum, but I'm also in my spare time an LGBT activist, and I chair Bolton's LGBT panel, and also do a lot of bi activism. And coming with that background, so I understand all the academic side, but obviously work a lot with the bi community. And what I'm really interested in, leading on from the bi invisibility side of it, is how, when we're trying to look at these sort of much more academic descriptions and not putting bi label onto it, how you then give the bi community the access to their history and the role models that were there in history of people that had multiple gendered relationships. So if you're publishing on these things, if you're producing documents and stuff, how do you make it so that the non-academic, the non-museum specialist can access in and go, okay, these were individuals who were having these types of relationships, I can see myself in the past.
Particularly if that's the key term, search words.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Multiple gender, you might be looking for that.
Yeah.
You're looking for bi.
You're just
1970s.
Looking for bi. You know, when you're first coming out and you're first identifying, all you do is, okay, here's a label that fits me. Who else was like this? Where do I fit in history? So I'm interested to know how the panel feel about that.
As far as I'm concerned, it seems to be that one of the key things that one has to distinguish is between the historical utility of the term and the way we would talk about it today. And in fact, we did a project at my university where we went back through our entire library and tried to figure out, in this instance, we were using the term lesbian, but we could have done it with bi as well, right, how one takes a gigantic university library and re-catalogs it from the beginnings, right, sensitive to the very search words that young students now use. What we found was that it was damn near impossible. We just got into huge battles when it came to archival material, because in the 19th century, women were like signing letters, I love you, I kiss you, I can't wait to hold your neck, what the hell are we going to do with that, right? So it's a really important question, and I have no idea.
Yeah, similarly, I don't think, this is something that I've wrestled with a lot in, and continue to do so. I kind of feel like there's like two sides of my brain, similar to what you were talking about. There's the like academic side that's doing the PhD and it's like, oh, query everything. And like, and then there's the like more political side of me, which both wants bisexual representation and also is conscious of the fact that a lot of my interviewees want bisexual, like they agree to be interviewed because they know how important it is to kind of have their history and all of that sort of thing. So it would feel insulting to them to and it's something that I think is really difficult. Obviously the interviewees who identify as bisexual are bisexual, and that's quite nice and straightforward. The Paul Carpenter interviews I obviously don't have responsibility for. I mean, I haven't investigated what's going to happen when I archive my interviews, which I will do. I think probably I would try and tag them as multiple gender attraction and bisexuality, because that's the like premise of the project. I find, although I was talking about the ethical dilemmas with the Paul Carpenter interviews, with my own interviewees, I find that slightly less problematic, because even the ones who identify as lesbian volunteered to be interviewed for a project about multiple gender attraction and bisexuality. So I don't think they would hate having, like, being considered under multiple gender attraction, although it's a really awkward and annoying term. But I think that, you know, I refer to them as lesbian because that's how they refer to themselves. But I sort of talk about them as, you know, people who experience multiple gender attraction and stuff. So, yeah, in terms of kind of general political representation, I think it's difficult particularly, I found difficult particularly in relation to bisexuality, because this is oversimplifying a bit, but I feel like at least with lesbian and particularly gay men's history, there's kind of been the like recovery and empowerment process, and then there's the kind of like, let's clear everything and question things and like problematize, so it's kind of gone through a process, whereas I feel like with bisexuality there hasn't been the recovery stuff yet. So I wonder if I'm sort of trying to jump that, and I suppose when sort of talking to my supervisors and stuff, one thing that they have suggested is to just kind of do different things in different contexts. So, you know, in the PhD thesis, that's an academic thing, but then that doesn't prevent me from publishing, you know, stuff for wider audiences or, you know, exhibiting stuff and things like that. So I think that's what I'm kind of leaning towards at the moment. I know it's a bit of a non-answer, but trying to kind of cover several bases, basically, and... yeah, hopefully I'll be able to do that.
Hi, I have another... thank you for all your really interesting talks. I had another question for you, because you said there was a rejection of Western or like modern labels, like, and you said gay and bisexual, so it's interesting to know those two. If that that was actually mentioned, so that bisexual is not an option. And were there other Polish terms? Were there Polish terms that they did use for themselves, that did come up? And mm-hmm. are they still in use now? Are they still in circulation? Are they a counter narrative to certain universities? So, because you were saying we have to break, east versus west. Is that just being taken over by the West? Is that mm-hmm. how the pink curtain is disappearing, or how are these terms negotiated?
For example, piquetier. Mm-hmm. Is that what's the word for cruising?
Piquetier.
What is it? Thanks.
They don't think of it as gay, because in the 70s this word was not used in England. It became used in the late 80s and the 90s. When talking about that time of their life, they don't think of themselves as being gay at that time. They couldn't have used that word. Of course, there were other words, some of them slurs, like peda, which you can translate as faggot, which now there are some groups and parts of the community in Poland that are now reclaiming the word as the word queer, but at that time this was a slur, and there were others like this, words like this. So what I meant by saying that they reject these categories is that they often use euphemism or coded talk, both to reflect about their experience from that time and to kind of talk about how they talked to each other and how they identified each other. So they wouldn't even use the word homosexual, because it sounded, kind of medical discourse and that part of this word. And they would use often words like friends, but like a female version. So like, a female friend, a girlfriend, something like that, to address each other. And lots of these coded words, I think, were much more popular than, just a straight category like homosexual.
And is that word girlfriend? I don't know what it is in Polish.
Girlfriend, the koleżanka.
Koleżanka, is that used today still?
I don't think it's that popular. I mean, I think it's a generational thing.
I don't know, but I think it's really interesting. Especially Brisbane, obviously you have terms that go in and out of fashion, don't you? The resurgence of queer now.
Yeah. Yeah. Dorothy.
Dorothy.
Yeah.
Great. We're out of time. Is there any pressing questions, or are you happy to catch up with speakers?
No, just very quick.
Sure.
So I'm Tom, I'm from the Benchmark and Archives. Just very quickly on the point of how you catalogue things and how you don't catalogue things. If you've got archaic terms, or you can always produce like a glossary of terms that you can use to search the collection, as sort of a short measure in between recataloguing everything and doing that, so you can give your users terms that they might need to search your collection as a sort of a bridge between the specialist terms in the collection and what's kind of popular.
But it doesn't necessarily bridge the ethics of applying those terms when you're searching for them if those people didn't use, and that's also
I think that might be that could be a back and forth, but it's something to consider.
But we also use the term marriage to describe 12th century, 15th century, and so why do we have to bear that burden?
And you're talking to a trans person, and if I can't use trans, how am I ever going to find anything?
Right.
Thanks very much for your attention.